Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, the V-Spot's back on the air. Steve Englehart has joined us again, which I really appreciate. I was just telling him that there was so much stuff that we didn't get a chance to cover last episode. So, Mr. Englehart, I guess what I want to ask you about first, because this is probably your most famous work. I don't know if it's more famous than the Marvel, but you had a very famous role in Batman with Marshall Rogers.
Right.
And I want to ask you, how did you get the job of writing Batman?
Well, I had left Marvel. I had been at Marvel to that point my entire comic book writing career, but I had left them, and DC was right. They were pretty much rock bottom at that point. All the people who had been stars at DC had gone to Marvel, and so they were looking for somebody to come from Marvel and help them out. So they the new publisher, Jeanette Kahn, over there contacted me and asked me if I would come over and write Justice League for them, and she said specifically, you know, do for the Justice League what you did for the Avengers, you know, I mean, get us into the modern age and all. And I said I'd be happy to do that, but I really wanted to write Batman in and of himself, too, because I liked Batman so much. So she said, okay. And so I went over to D.C. and did write, you know, both the Justice League and Batman and a few other things while I was there. That was pretty much the turnaround for D.C.
Okay. Now, one thing I noticed is that you brought back Hugo Strange into the Batman universe, and he had not been seen for a very long time. What? And it was the same with Deadshot, that he was like a one-time Batman villain in the 50s.
Right.
What made you decide to go back and get those old villains instead of creating a new one like you did with Dr. Phosphorus?
Well, I thought, you know, again, I was there to kind of save DC on, you know, to put it in single words, and I thought that one thing that had really been lost on the Batman was the real darkness of the early years, when they had republished now and again a few stories from the early years of Batman, and, you know, the back of annuals and stuff was all we knew about at the time, and I really liked the whole dark pulp atmosphere of the whole thing, so I wanted to get that going again. I wanted to do that, and so they have a library at DC, and I asked them, could I get Xeroxes of, like, the first couple years of Detective Comics and Batman? And they went in, they sent some intern in there and made those copies, which incidentally probably sparked the whole Masterworks, whatever DC calls their version of it, but the whole reprint of the old stuff thing, because it hadn't happened before then. But that was just a sidebar. But I read those early stories, and Hugo Strange was in them, and I was, you know, I was looking for somebody to really bring back that era, and of course the Joker has been stuck around, he was there, but I mean everybody else from that era, there was Dala the Vampire, and, you know, there was that kind of stuff, so I just picked Hugo Strange and his giant monsters as something that I could, you know, revamp for the 70s, but keep that same sort of pulp mad scientist with the monsters kind of vibe going. And I'll just mention Deadshot was not the same thing. I was only going to be at DC for a year. I had decided, my wife, before she met me, had traveled in Europe for a year by herself and with friends, and I had never done that, and I wanted to do that. So I had planned to go to Europe in a year. So, I mean, when I went to D.C., I told them, you know, I'm only going to do whatever I can do in a year. And for Detective Comics, that was theoretically 7 issues, because it was published monthly in the summer and bi-monthly in the winter or something like that. But then when I got started on it, the sales reacted so quickly that they decided to try to cram another issue in. And so they came to me at one point and said, well, you know, now we're going to put another issue in the midst of your run, and that turned out to be a good thing, because I was able to use that issue for more character stuff, and I mean, I don't think it's the Deadshot issue, but you wouldn't necessarily know that that was an extra issue, because I just was able to expand the storylines that I had, and work with it. But I had no villain for that issue. And Julie Schwartz, actually, the editor on the book, suggested Deadshot. I have no idea why, because Deadshot from the 50s was a guy who wore a tuxedo and holster, you know, gun holster like a cowboy around his tuxedo. He's a dumb villain in his original incarnation. But for some reason, Julie suggested him, and so, you know, Marshall redesigned him, and we made use of him.
Were you surprised that he took off like he did?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm surprised. As I say, the original version was so lame, but, you know, Marshall and I were both, and Terry Austin as well, on the inks. We were all big Batman fans, and I tried to, you know, to turn Deadshot into somebody worth caring about, and then Marshall redesigned him, and the art was great, and so on and so forth. So, considering our track record, I guess I'm not surprised, but I can't say that I went into it with the idea. I mean, as I say, I didn't even think about Deadshot until he was presented to me, and all I saw was somebody that I didn't like. So I guess I'm a little surprised that we were able to do that much with him, you know?
Okay. Now, you also did work with the classic villains like Joker and Penguin. In the case of Penguin, it was a very good mystery story. Did you find that more difficult than doing a straightforward action story?
Well, it was not more difficult, but again, I in my mind, I had 7, later 8 issues to completely rehabilitate the Batman, and part of that, or simultaneous, was that I really loved the Batman, and I wanted to do the best Batman that I could do by my lights, you know. So the traditional, again, a lot of traditions had been lost at that point. But I mean, one of the things with the Penguin was a detective sort of thing. I mean, it was Detective Comics, right? I mean, Batman had never been too constrained by the fact that he was appearing in Detective Comics, but he was supposed to be a detective, the Dark Detective, as a matter of fact. And so I wanted to do a sort of classic Batman mystery story for that issue. You know, I mean, again, every issue I was trying to do something classic, but, you know, take some classic vibe and revamp it, bring it into the modern era and so forth. So it wasn't what I was used to doing. I didn't, you know, do flat out mysteries like that very often, but it's what I wanted to do. So, you know, I put my mind to it.
All right. And the last thing about Batman is you did the very famous Joker story, which might be one of the Joker stories about the laughing fish. Where
right.
did you get that idea at?
That just came out of the blue. I mean, I was sitting there, you know, again, building up toward, I knew that the climax of my run on Batman would be a big Joker thing. I mean, he's the guy for Batman. But the thing with the Joker to that point, in the first year of Batman, in the pulp era, he was a homicidal maniac. And he did, you know, there were things he did that were weird. They weren't necessarily insane, but they were weird, and he was a killer and all that kind of stuff. And over the years, he'd become this clown. He'd become, you know, a guy who told jokes and laughed around. And before I got there, Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams had sort of taken him in a darker direction, but their Batman was still pretty clean cut, shall we say. And the Joker, although darker, was also in that same thing. So I really wanted to make this guy insane. I mean, just crazy. And I, as I just said, you know, I sit there and I go, oh, I think I'd like to do this. Now it's up to me to do it. And, you know, so I sat there for a while thinking, well, how do I exactly make this guy crazy? And I came up with this idea of the laughing fish. I mean, just, you know, this plan, which to any reader is going to sound like nuts, which was the point, you know. So I don't know why fish as opposed to ferrets or anybody else, but, you know, but I just all sort of came together. And again, all those scripts, after the first couple, after Marshall Rogers came on and the art, I was doing them script in advance because I did have a deadline. I was leaving the country. And so I wrote those scripts without knowing what the art was going to look like, and, in fact, not knowing who the artist was going to be. Marshall, you know, I write the scripts, obviously, in advance of the art, and I was writing them more and more in advance of when they needed to be drawn. So I did not know that DC had chosen Marshall and Terry to be the artists on this book. I was just writing the best scripts I could draw. But I've said a million times, you know, the level of talent at DC at that time was pretty low. I mean, there were good guys, certainly still there, but, you know, they were probably doing something. The people who would be sort of available to take on a one-off Batman series were probably pretty limited. And so I was writing these scripts, trying to make them as, you know, the best scripts I could make on the theory that the art wasn't really going to hold up its end of the deal. And I turned out to be, you know, amazingly surprised on that score. But what I've said many times is that if those exact same scripts had been given to, you know, journeyman guys, you wouldn't think so highly of the final result. I mean, it'd be the exact same words and the exact same story, but the art obviously plays an incredible part in the overall experience. And so I was very fortunate that I got two guys who loved the Batman and really wanted to kick ass on it. So, you know, the Joker holding those fish on the cover of the issue, it's an iconic image now, but I don't know that it would have been, you know, if it had just been sort of standard DC art of the time. The last thing I would say about that, just because I'm rolling on that, DC hated their art. I did not know this at the time, didn't know it for years. It wasn't until we got back together to do Dark Detective that they were telling me that when they were doing the original stuff in the 70s, they were both called into the office every month and just ripped up and down one side and the other about how awful this art was. And
really?
Of course, yep, we don't think that now, but they, you know, DC, there was a reason DC was in the toilet in those days. I mean, they were really sort of stuck in the 50s, and they really didn't understand, you know, stuff. I mean, I was pretty much left. I was brought in, you know, as I said, I mean, I was specifically brought in to sort of save the company. And so I was given free rein. I mean, I was brought in by the publisher, so there was nobody who was going to mess with me. But those guys were just, you know, given an art assignment. And so they were fair game to be told that they were drawing really lousy artwork. So it just goes to show you.
Some of these stories ended up being adapted in TV episodes of the animated series in the 90s. Were you compensated for that?
I was, yeah. DC has a very dubious program where if they think that they owe you money, they'll give you some. But it's entirely up to them as to whether they think, and it's inconsistent. For example, Joe Staten and I get compensated whenever Kilowog shows up because we created Kilowog, but we don't get compensated for Guy Gardner because they say, oh, Guy Gardner, you know, was created back in the 60s by, you know, and we say, well, you know, our Guy Gardner is a completely different guy. He just has the same name. And they go, that's enough for us. We don't have to give you any money. So, you know, it's dubious, but I did get compensated for those Batman things. Yeah. And
all right.
You know.
All right, let me ask you about Green Lantern, because unfortunately I haven't had a chance to read those, but after the show aired, I had a couple of people tell me how much they really loved your run on Green Lantern Corps. Can you tell me how you got that assignment, and were you still working at Marvel at the time you were doing this?
I was. I had gone to Europe, come back from Europe, and I was writing my first novel, and then I got hired to be a game designer at Atari. And so I was completely out of comics in the early 80s. And as I say, I was working at Atari. And I went for sort of old time's sake, or maybe I did it every year, I don't remember. But I did go down to the Comic Con in San Diego in 82, I guess. And both Marvel in the person of Jim Shooter and DC in the person of Dick Giordano came up to me and said, "Hey, you want to come back and write some comics for us?" And I said, "No, I'm fully employed, working at Atari." And came home from that weekend, and Sunday night, my boss at Atari called up, and he said, "They just sold the company, and I think we're all going to get fired on Wednesday." So next morning, I called up both Marvel and DC, and I said, maybe I would. So, Marvel welcomed me back and gave me, West Coast Avengers and Vision Witch and other stuff. But I Dick Giordano and I were old friends. I had known Dick for a long time. I'd known him before I got into comics because we both lived in Connecticut at the time. And he'd been very helpful. And I also thought, I had a good time at DC previously. And all in all, I'd just as soon work for both of these guys. And, there was no secret about it. I said, I told both of them I was going to work for the other guy, too, and they said, okay. So I was doing the bulk of my work at Marvel, but I had the one series, Green Lantern, and that was just Dick Giordano said, "That's the series I need you to take on over here now." And I'd always been a big Green Lantern fan. I mean, as I sort of mentioned, I'm sure last time we did this, I was a big comic book fan before I was a comic book person. And so there were lots of series that I was, would have been happy to work on. And Green Lantern was certainly one of them. So once again, I researched it. I'd read all the stuff, but I went back and worked out the whole Guardians of the Universe and Oa and the Zamorans and all the, all the classic stuff and tried to put that together in a modern day package and I think the big thing there, I don't know how far you wanted to go on that question, but the thing there was when I took it over, John Stewart was the Green Lantern and Hal Jordan had quit and it said he was never coming back and everybody knew that he would, but now it was up to me to kind of manage that when I took it over in the middle of that concept. And, I said, "Well, okay, Hal's got to come back, but why does that mean John has to leave? I mean, John is just as much Green Lantern as Hal is." And these days that's not such a debatable statement, but back in those days it was because he hadn't, been Green Lantern. He's considered the fill-in Green Lantern. But it gave me the idea, why not have two of them? And then it gave me the idea, why not have three of them and get Guy Gardner, who had been, as I say, there had been a Guy Gardner who had appeared like twice or three times or something over the previous 20 years. But he, he had a connection. And then from there, I said, well, why not have a Green Lantern Corps? Why not get a group of them? And that's how, that led, one thing led to the other. So pretty soon we had the Green Lantern Corps with all the cool Green Lanterns in it, and it became a template for a lot of stuff too. Yeah.
Did you create Chip?
Yeah. Well, I didn't create. No. Did you say did I create him? No, I didn't create him.
Yeah.
I created Kilowog and Guy Gardner. I brought in Chip.
Okay.
I brought in Psylocke. I brought in Arisia. I'm forgetting somebody. I think maybe not. Maybe the rest of them are all humans. But Yeah, I went back and found the ones that I liked. What was interesting to me is, you know, I was saying earlier about DC's compensation thing. You know, Joe and I are not pleased that we're not getting paid for Guy Gardner, but I was telling Joe, well, you know, they also did give me a couple really minor guys, and it turned out that he's the co-creator on pretty much all the rest of the people we're talking about here. I mean, with different writers, he co-created Salak, and he co-created Arisia and so forth. So, and I hadn't even realized that I was picking characters that he'd been involved in necessarily. They were just cool characters.
Okay, let me ask you, because running Green Lantern Corps, it seems like that would be a challenge just to have a team, you know, and they all have the same powers. How did you approach that?
Well, my stories aren't about the powers, you know. They were each individual characters. That's why I chose them, because they were, each one had a different personality and a different background and a different so on and so forth. So it really didn't bother me that they all did the same thing, in a sense, because each one of them was approaching it from a different standpoint, and that was what was interesting to me.
All right. At Marvel, you were doing, like I said, you did the Vision Scarlet Witch limited series, and you were the one that ended up marrying them back in the 70s.
All right.
Can you tell me, how did you approach the limited series and also the ideal of having Scarlet Witch get pregnant by Vision?
Well, I was, you know, I say this about so many different things, but I mean, I really liked the Vision and the Witch, you know. I mean, as characters, I hadn't even totally realized it, but I've been writing the introductions for the Marvel Masterworks reprints of the stuff that I wrote, and from the start, I had gravitated toward Vision and Witch as the kind of focal point of my Avengers. We talked last time about how I keep, you know, everybody in a group functioning and, you know, keep it a group. But a lot of the stories, the through line, even before Mantis showed up, and then once Mantis showed up, certainly, it sort of hinged on the relationship of the Vision and the Witch. And I really liked that relationship. I mean, the Vision, or the Witch, is, you know, in your face. I mean, she takes no shit from anybody, and the Vision is actually the calm one of the two, but that dynamic I thought was really interesting, and I liked them, and Roy had started them out as this, you know, weird romance that her brother hated and all this kind of stuff, and people rioted because he was an android marrying or you know, hanging around with a humanoid, blah, blah, blah. So I, in the Avengers, I moved them forward and put them through the big romantic story with Mantis, and in the end, as you say, they got married. That seemed to me to be, I didn't want them to be in some sort of limbo, some comic book limbo where they just kind of sat around in the same situation year after year. I wanted to see them move forward. So then, you know, 5 years later, whatever it was, when they offered me the Vision Witch miniseries, I thought, okay, well, I remember I went to dinner in New Jersey with Richard Howell, who was the artist on that, and we were sitting there talking about stuff, and I said, well, then the next step would be kids, and he loved it, and so, you know, we thought, all right, we got 12 issues. We could do it monthly, so we could have 9 months when she's pregnant and she could deliver. You know, it all kind of just fit together. So that was, you know, I was continuing the relationship between these two people that you know, the world, or at least some people in the Marvel Universe, thought should never be together. This was obviously long before gay marriage and so forth. I mean, it was long before gay marriage. It wasn't, and that sort of thing wasn't on anybody's radar in those days. So I wasn't making any political statement beyond whatever I was saying about the rights of synthesoids. But, you know, they ought to be married, and if they're married, then they ought to have kids, it seemed to me, and that's where I wanted to go with them. Obviously, you know, I got him the kids, and then as soon as I left Marvel that time, John Byrne trashed the kids and turned him into a toaster, and that's another that's a whole other era. But if, you know, if I'd stuck around, if I'd been around, those kids would have, you know, would have grown up and had powers and probably hung out with Franklin Richards and ended up at Professor X's school for gifted youngsters. I mean, it was all in place. But if I had stuck with them, I would have continued to move them forward. But it all just comes from the fact that I liked them. You know, I wanted them to find happiness. That's about it.
All right, let me ask you also, because this is connected to the kids. You created Master Pandemonium for Avengers West Coast as another, you know, big villain for the Avengers. How did he come about?
Well, I was trying to create a big villain. The West Coast Avengers didn't have any particular villain of their own, and so I was trying to create one. I like Master Pandemonium. I'm not sure he totally worked. I mean, a guy who breaks off into demons, it's kind of an interesting concept, but it was sort of hard to actually put on the page. Yeah, that was, you know, I said they don't have a Doctor Doom. They don't have a Kang of their own, you know. So let's create somebody on that level, and that was my attempt at it.
All right. Now, you mentioned the John Byrne run, you know, what he did with Vision, and eventually, you know, he connected Master Pandemonium to the kids, and I was wondering, did you have an opinion on that story one way or another, or did you just look at it as that's the breaks when you work at a big company?
Well, probably both. I mean, it is the breaks when you work at a big company. You always, I mean, you know, every series that, well, not every, you know, I created some series, but most series that I worked on, I picked up from somebody. I always thought that if I did that, I should try to make the transition as seamless as possible. I would always have some idea about where I wanted to go, but rather than say, hi, I'm here now, this is, we just went there, I generally turned it into a, you know, the first story about how we moved from where we were to where I wanted them to be. Byrne had a different approach. Byrne would show up and go, hi, I'm here, it's all different. It was disrespectful, in my opinion, and, you know, I'm not a big John Byrne fan, and I'm not a fan of that approach, and I'm not a fan of specifically what he did with the West Coast Avengers and all that. So I have actually never read most of John Byrne's run, and so I didn't read that story, but I'm sure I would have disliked it. I just think, you know, I would drop, you know, when I was doing Batman, I got into it, but I would put in, you know, the Fox Gardens in honor of Gardner Fox and the Broom Galleries in honor of John Broom, so forth. I mean, I appreciate what people, I mean, if those guys hadn't done cool stuff, I wouldn't have liked a series by the time I got there and got my shot at it. So I was never into trashing the guys who came before me. I never to this day understand exactly why John was, but that was his thing.
Now, I think a couple, I don't really read a lot of current comics for whatever reason, but I think a couple of years ago they actually did bring back the kids.
I'm not surprised. I mean, again, I know nothing about that because I haven't been following the stuff for a while now because I've been out of comics, but nobody ever, you know, nobody's gone forever. You know, I mean, it's because they're all properties at the end of the day. I mean, if you get it right down to the nub, they're all properties. And so, you know, Marvel owns those kids. Why not make a buck off of them somehow? I suppose. But I have no idea what they did with them or you know.
You also had another series you had a big run on was Doctor Strange, and you did a pretty famous story where the world was destroyed and recreated.
Right.
And I was wondering, how did that idea come about?
Well, Doctor Strange was a series of big events. I mean, Strange, being the Sorcerer Supreme, needed to deal with cosmic, things, in my opinion. I mean, I think it's fairly clear just from this conversation. Every series, I try to figure out what that series is really about and write that series in and of itself and not just write the same series again and again and again with a different guy. So with Strange, I set out to do, cosmic wonder and big ticket items. And so we had, done at early on in the run, Strange had met God, and then he met Mother Nature, he met Death. And so I was working with archetypes, really, and it just occurred to me that in the same way, the same thought as, like, well, Hal Jordan's going to come back, so Jon Stewart has to go. Well, why does Jon Stewart have to go? It was the same thing, in that stories about the end of the world always end with the world not ending. And I thought, well, why not end the world? You know, why not actually follow through on this? Because he was dealing with cosmic forces, we were able to recreate the world, which was kind of interesting. I mean, I was doing all this in Doctor Strange, and so I ended the world and then recreated the world exactly as it had been before. What I was getting at was, Strange knows things that we don't know, and one of the things he was going to have to carry now was that everybody on the planet had died, and then, they didn't know it. And since they didn't know it, it didn't make any difference to them, but he knew it and would have to live with that. What was interesting was some of the other writers then, Len Wein, I remember, was upset that Peter Parker had died, and now this was a second Peter Parker. And I'm like, well, it's the same, it was recreated by cosmic forces, so Peter doesn't know it. There is no difference. He's exactly the same. It doesn't affect your stuff at all. But some people thought about it more than others, and it wasn't universally beloved at Marvel. But obviously, everybody recovered and went on. I really didn't think about it. I mean, I thought, if you can't tell the difference between Peter Parker's and he doesn't know anything, then what difference does it make? But depends on how deeply you do think about it, I suppose.
It's kind of like that quote from a Conan story, about where he was talking about illusion, and how if he's an illusion, then he's, and everything else is, then life is just as real.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things I was doing overall with Strange was that, Strange somehow stands outside of the rest of us and sees it with, bigger eyes because he knows more. He knows what's going on behind the scenes, and So I set myself, when I took over Strange, I set myself to being able to write a guy who could do that, which meant I had to then sort of, look at stuff from a larger standpoint. I had to write a character who sounded like he knew stuff that the rest of us didn't. And since I'm the rest of us, part of the rest of us, I had to work there to try to, write somebody who was more cosmically aware than I was, I could just say, the Crimson Bands of Sitarak and let it go at that. But I was trying to do something more with that series. And that was the route that I wanted to take. So that's the route that I took.
To go back to Captain America for a second, because I didn't get a chance to ask about this, about the Secret Empire storyline. Can you tell me, what was the genesis of that storyline for you?
Well, that was a story that just sort of grew over time. I started out just sort of doing, we talked last time about throwing plates in the air. I mean, that's something where I just said, okay, here's something mysterious I can drop into Captain America. I'll figure out, you know, what the, how it all fits in later. And so in the beginning, there was Moonstone, the villain, and there was, you know, various things. But right in the middle of doing that came the Watergate scandal. And, you know, I said to myself, there's no way that Captain America, if Captain America is supposed to be living in the real world, there's no way that he's not going to have some reaction to the president being impeached and so on and so forth. So I melded this mysterious, this, you know, the whatever was going on with Moonstone and the various guys into what turned out to be this thing where the president, you know, committed suicide in the White House and Captain America was disillusioned and went off to become the Nomad and so forth. I mean, that was a case of, you know, I had several plates in the air, and when they were coming down, you know, that wasn't where I expected them to come down. But when they came down, I was in the middle of this thing and just, you know, grabbed them and stuck them into that plot, and we were off to the races. I had the X-Men in that thing, too. I mean, I was, they were, right. There was all sorts of stuff in that. We talked last time about, you know, I was the only one using the X-Men at that time. Whenever I could, I'd stick them in. And I like complexity, you know. I mean, I don't shy away from complexity. You know, if I was doing something and it was going great, I'd say, let's see if we can ramp it up another notch. And that was kind of my approach.
Let me ask you, this is like a very minute point. How did Secret Empire get the drop on Blob and Eunice?
I don't remember, tell you the truth.
You didn't, yeah, it's not mentioned in the story, though. I was just figuring, you know, it's like, which I thought was very well done, you know, because it didn't bring up any questions. I just found it funny, you know, the X-Men come in, you know, and they find their friends, and they're like, oh, Blob, you're alive. Thank God.
Yeah, that part I don't remember, really.
Okay. Yeah, that's why. It's, I just thought it's funny. You know, they're all, they have them Blob so big they had to put him on a separate table. Let me ask you: when the X Men came back for the, were you still at Marvel when they did the all new, all different X Men?
I think I was not. Or at least I just overlapped it briefly. I mean, because there was originally the giant size book with Len Wein and Dave Cockrum, and then I think they only did the one issue, and then you know, Byrne and Claremont took over. And my... No, I think, actually, I think I was, but just barely. Because I'm pretty sure the X-Men blew up while I was in Europe. I seem to remember coming back from Europe and being told the X-Men was a huge thing, and I'm like, really? Really? I did not know that. So I think I missed most of it, at least.
Well, you know, that's one of the things that I noticed when I was looking at the Captain America run. It's strange to think of a time, and again, I really, like, I can, like, you know, like, I can understand it, you know, but it's hard for me and people of my generation to understand that the X-Men were at one time not a big deal.
Well, we did talk about this last time, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
just,
so
I was just noticing.
Yeah, I'm not going to go through
the whole.
Yeah, I won't go through the whole thing again. But it just, you know, I think it was because the X-Men came out the same month as the Avengers when they debuted, and the Avengers, they were both bi-monthly, and then after about three or four issues, Avengers became monthly, and it, you know, it was the Avengers and all this kind of stuff, and X-Men never did become monthly, or not for a long time. Yeah, it did become eventually, but not for a long time. And I think X-Men was just always considered to be a second-rank book in its original incarnation. And so when people had to save their money, they dropped the X-Men before they dropped the Avengers. And just, you know, it just never really – I mean, it ran 67 issues, but it still was never a big hit its first time around. And yet, I mean, now there's 5 million X-Men, but, I mean, the original five are still there. There's no question about who they are, but they weren't. They couldn't make it go the first time. And I think it's mostly, again, sort of fan prejudice rather than the value of the characters. Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to ask you, because I keep being asked about this, can you tell me about Mantis, how she was created and became part of the Avengers?
Well, I wanted, the first sort of plot line, long-term plot line that I came up with for the Avengers was I wanted to have a femme fatale come in and sort of put the moves on every male Avenger. Again, we're back before I would have thought about having her put the moves on the female Avengers. But, she was going to cause dissension in the ranks by flirting with Thor and flirting with Iron Man, who probably wouldn't have much trouble with that. And, that's what she was introduced to be. But I had... in order to get her into the Avengers, I had hooked her up with the Swordsman. And the Swordsman, had been an Avenger for like an issue and a half back in the day. And then it had all gone wrong and we hadn't seen him in a long time. And so I was able to build this backstory in order to get him into the thing. But I introduced her. And again, I just was going through this in the Masterworks, so I've had a chance to actually look at it again and think about it. She was introduced to be basically a slut, and she got into the group just in time for the Avengers Defenders thing, which I wasn't, I hadn't been planning to do that, and then I can't remember whether we said this last time or not, but I mean, Marvel used to do annuals every summer, and they, for whatever reason, they weren't going to do annuals that summer, and I said, I really want to do something big for the summer. And I came up with this idea sort of on the spur of the moment of Avengers Defenders. And so I had to break everybody up into teams, and I had to have them do stuff. And so as soon as she appeared, Mantis, instead of seducing people, was thrown into being a teammate. She worked with the Black Panther against Doctor Strange in that thing. And she was a good teammate. I mean, she sort of had to be a good teammate if she was going to be in the Avengers. But by being a good teammate, all of a sudden I couldn't make her this evil femme fatale so much anymore. So she then was there and she was part of the group, but her original purpose, her original reason for existence was pretty much washed away. I kept playing with the idea of her being a romantic somehow involved in a thing, and that hooked in with Vision and Witch, as I said before, because they were kind of the leading exponents of romance, if not the leading exponents of the where I went with my stories in those days. So it was just kind of like, it's not like throwing plates up, but it's kind of an equivalent in that, there she was, and then she did something. The thing I learned out of that was, as a young writer, was every decision matters. I mean, you can say, I'm going to go in this particular direction, but in this particular story, this character goes in a different direction because that's what the story demands. And then so next month you come back and you go, well, I really was planning on her going to the right, but she's taken a step to the left. And so now I have to work with that. And so what's the next step? And Mantis is a character who really sort of wrote herself, as I always say. I mean, she just, every issue, there'd be something that she would pretty much have to do because of what she'd done to that point. And it was just kind of leading me along. I'm like, oh, really? That's what she's doing this month? Okay, well then, I'll work with that. And once I got into that, once I started saying, that's kind of cool, I mean, that I don't know what she's doing, but she's doing it step by step, so it all hangs together. Then I thought, well, how many steps can we take? How big can we make this? And it's the same thing as what I was saying before about Doctor Strange. It's like, well, let's make this complex. Let's build this up and do all this stuff. And so it took it. It was like a year and a half was her. Her run was like a year and a half from mysterious bar girl from Saigon to the celestial Madonna,
I was going to ask about that, the Celestial Madonna story. What made you come up with that?
Well, again, I was just trying to get something bigger and bigger, and you know, by that time, the whole idea of going from mysterious bar girl from Saigon to goddess, you know, I loved that arc. It wasn't, you know, I didn't plan on that arc, but, you know, somewhere along that arc, I said, this is where it seems to be going. You know, it was the 70s, which was when Earth Day was first created, and there was a lot of interest in the environment for the first time as a mass movement. So I ended up having her being the bridge between us and plants, with her marrying the spirit in the tree and so forth. It just was, you know, I wanted to do some sort of goddess, and there was a goddess that hadn't been done, so I did that one.
Okay, now this is a story. You also did a storyline that ended up killing Swordsman, and I think it gave him the way it was done. It ended up, I think you gave Swordsman a lot more pathos than he had before.
Yeah, well, you know, he was a minor character. He was, you know, he was never anybody's idea of a major character. But he was in my Avengers, so he was going to get his due. You know, everybody in that group got their day in the sun. And you know, I'm sure I had realized that Mantis was going to leave him behind and try to go with the Vision by that point. So I tried to think of how I could honor him the most while leaving him behind, which meant, a death full of pathos. That particular story, Avengers 129 and Giant Size Avengers 2, which is basically one story, that's one of my top five favorite stories. I mean, I really liked the way everything worked out in that, you know, 40, 50 pages run, whatever that was. And it just, you know, it just, everything worked, Kang, go through time, blah, 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 and then it all comes down to him dying at the end, and that's just, you know, something that just worked pretty much the way I wanted it to.
One last thing I wanted to ask about was that you've wrote in a lot of different mediums. Like you were talking about writing a novel earlier, and you've also wrote episodes of television. How do those compare to writing comics? Like the mindset and the setting it up. How do those compare?
Well, I always say that, you know, it's like playing baseball, and as you travel around, you play in different parks where the fences are at different distances and so forth, but it's all baseball. I mean, it's baseball, but you have to adapt to the park you're in. And I think that's a pretty accurate description of it. I mean, writing is writing. Characters are characters. But in some places you have less space to do things. I mean, animation, anything with television, anything that's spoken word, you can't write very much dialogue for. I mean, if you wrote the same amount of dialogue that you write for a comic book page, it would, you know, television series would be 3 hours long, you know. I mean, it's just people can say a lot more on the printed page than they can say in physical reality. So you end up, you know, making your points much more succinctly if you're writing for stuff that's going to be spoken. When I did video games, you could write as much as you wanted to, but it all had to be, you know, in the service of the game. I enjoyed it when I was able to stick in character bits, but those were definitely stick-ins rather than the main part of it back in the day. I mean, now, you know, games today are massive movie-type things, but back in the 80s, we were still dealing with fairly limited technology by today's standards. Again, I always say I'm glad that I started out as a comic book writer because I was given unlimited freedom and lots of space, and I could try anything I wanted to and see how it went. And so I learned while doing and doing a lot. I think when I first got involved in Hollywood, I was thinking, the norm down there is for people to, you spend 6 months writing a spec script, and then you spend 6 months wandering around town flogging it. And if it doesn't work, you go back and you spend the next 6 months writing another script. I mean, it's like, so you write a whole lot less in other, at least in most other genres. Comics was a great training ground for being a writer, I think, and then you can take that anywhere.
Are your novels still in print?
Yep, they are. You can find them on Amazon or any other online place, and possibly at your local store, too. The Point Man, the Long Man, the Plain Man, and the Arena Man, which just came out a couple months ago, they're all available. They're all, basically, they're kind of like the stuff I was talking about with Doctor Strange, the large concepts, all set in the real world that we're all living in. So it's kind of a Doctor Strange meets Captain America vibe. I wanted to write what it would be like to be a real wizard in the real world. And so on the one hand, you've got to write the real wizard, but the other hand, you've got to write the real world. And so it's been interesting sort of chronicling America as it, as it is right now. And then having this guy up against it, this wizard and his few friends. Coyote and Scorpio Rose are in those books, by the way, since I own those characters, and they fit the
right,
fit that profile.
You did that.
I'm able to.
Very terrific.
Yes, yes. Coyote actually started with Eclipse, and Scorpio Rose actually started with DC, because Scorpio Rose was, I wrote some Madame Xanadus for DC, and then DC ripped me off, which they're wont to do. And so I took those scripts and went over to Eclipse, and we turned them into Scorpio Rose. So that's where that started, but Eclipse didn't last forever, and so I ended up doing Coyote and for Epic and Marvel, and then bringing Scorpio Rose in there, and then I've just sort of kept them alive ever since. They're characters I own, and I've used them here and there in comics, and I figured, why shouldn't I use them in my novels too? So, as I say, there's a connection between the novels and the comics.
Right. I'll definitely, because I've been planning on looking for those for a long time. I'm definitely going to look at them, and maybe after I read them, I can come back to discuss in more detail.
Sure, that would be great.
All right, I tell you, Mr. Englehart, my baby's in the living room, and she's getting anxious, so I think we're going to have to cut it off here, but thank you very much for coming on the show. Like I said, you've helped me so much, even in my own writing, just talking to you, it's helped me so much, like understanding things, and good luck with everything you're doing.
Thank you, thanks, and good luck with what you're doing.
Thank you very much, sir. We'll probably be back tonight to discuss, not me and Steve Englehart, but me and my co-host, Neil, we'll be back tonight to discuss the season finale in New Dallas. Good day, everybody.